House Bill 2055. Mr. Dodson.
House Bill 2055, Van Gross, authorizes addition of collection fee to debts owed to public body when the public body uses a private collection agency to collect the debt. Stipulates that the collection fee would be payable by the debtor and may not exceed the collection fee of the private collection agency. No revenue impact, fiscal statement issued, and there is an A4 amendment.
A4 amendment, okay. Okay, this is for a work session. Any comment on the A4 amendment? No problem with the A4 amendment?
Looking for a motion?
Yeah, I'll just move that there's no discussion. I'd move the A4 amendment.
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, maybe just explain what the A4 does that's different than what we had before.
The A4 amendment incorporates the -1, mm-hmm. the A1, and the A2 amendments. Mm-hmm.
Right.
A2 and A3 amendments.
Okay. Then I
have... And it also adds a due process requirement to notify or to make notification that there would be a question.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? If not, the amendment is adopted. The chair would move House Bill 2055 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And evidently Senator Winters would like to carry that. Is that correct? Does anybody have any questions with that? Like to be a co-carrier or anything? That was put Senator Winters down as the carrier of that. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 252. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 252 conforms insurance privacy notice to federal privacy notice requirements. Provides for notice at initiation of insurance transaction. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact. And we have an amendment.
Amendment. Okay. What does amendment do for us?
And this addresses Senator Hannon's concern.
Oh, take it removes the privacy section out of the
insurance privacy protection afforded in statutes.
Okay. Very good. Any discussion on the proposed amendment? If not, the chair would move A2s. To the bill. Any discussion? Any disagreement? No objections? So ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 252 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, the A2 almost eliminates the entire bill. There's not much left of it after that.
We're answering the concerns of the good Senator Hannon. So. Any further discussion? Any objection?
Bill.
252.
I did move it, didn't I?
Yeah.
Okay. So ordered. And Senator Metzger was started to carry that one. We got to that point. So, okay, Senate Bill. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 284. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 284 disqualifies individual from receipt of unemployment benefits for acts involving alcohol, marijuana, or unlawful drugs, or violation of last chance agreement. No revenue impact, fiscal statement issued.
Okay. Proponents of 284. Hello, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'd like to thank you for having the public hearing today on Senate Bill 284. We're here to ask your support of this bill. A couple of background comments. We introduced a similar bill last session, and towards the end of the session, we received a veto notice from Governor Kitzhaber. So we worked with labor and members of his staff on areas of concern. And the bill you see before you with Senate Bill 284 takes into consideration some of the issues that were raised last session with regards to the bill that was introduced then. Also, in the last week or so, we've heard from the Employment Department about some areas of concerns that they have, and we will be meeting with them later this week to try and address some of those concerns. So now, by way of background for the bill on why it's necessary, we have with us Dan Harmon of Hoffman Corporation, who will speak to that, and then Paula Barron with Barron Liebman will talk about what the bill does. Thank you.
Great. Dan, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Senator Nelson. Good afternoon. My name is Dan Harmon. I'm Vice President and General Counsel of Hoffman Corporation. Hoffman Corporation is the parent company of the Hoffman Construction Companies. We are the largest general contractor in the Northwest and one a very large employer of construction labor in the state of Oregon. I'm here today testifying in support of Senate Bill 284. I want to give you a little bit of background on some of the reasons why this bill is important. ORS 657.176 was designed to relieve employers from the expense of funding unemployment benefits for employees terminated for drug and alcohol-related misconduct. Unfortunately, the clear purpose of that bill is not being realized because of unclear implementing regulations and inconsistent rulings from hearings officers. The regulations were drafted in a way that gives unemployment hearings officers the ability to subjectively evaluate circumstances of an employer's drug and alcohol test and has led to some very conflicting results. In our case, we have had in the last 6 or 7 years 9 cases where we've experienced directly these very conflicting results. Two of the cases involved a failure of a pre-employment drug test, and in the rulings by the hearings officer, the written rulings, they stated, and I'll quote, your failure, this is to the employee who engaged in the misconduct, your failure of the pre-employment drug test was not wantonly negligent or a willful disregard of the employer's interest. Very surprising statement. We appealed those two particular cases and prevailed on appeal. We had several other cases where the hearings officer ruled that they were not discharged for misconduct. And in two of those particular cases, the ruling was, and this was a written ruling, that the individual was not discharged for misconduct because it was not a willful or wanton violation of the standards of behavior an employer has a right to expect. That's a very shocking result. We obviously appealed and prevailed. In all 9 cases we've appealed, we've prevailed, but we spent over $100,000 in that effort. I'm not here necessarily because of the dollars, although I don't believe that that's the way business ought to have to use their capital. I'm here because, and I'm a proponent of this bill, because what is happening in this area sends the wrong message. It sends the wrong message to employers who have or are considering implementing drug and alcohol tests as a part of their safety programs, because they're seeing the very high costs there are going downstream to defend their programs. It's the wrong message to Oregonians in terms of the use of precious state funds. Those funds, from administrative costs to benefits, are being provided to employees who are terminated or suspended for drug and alcohol-related misconduct. And finally, it sends the wrong message to prospective employees that those benefits are available if you engage in such misconduct. I want to tell you that the use of drug and alcohol in connection with the employment presents a serious risk of harm. Those who engage in that sort of conduct pose a grave risk to themselves, their co-workers, and the members of the public. Now, employers, the unions, and even the legislature have all taken good steps. There have been a number of bills that have been passed in the past few years. One, for example, is requiring all contractors on public work projects to have a drug and alcohol testing program. Very good step. The unions have taken very good steps by implementing their own drug and alcohol testing programs. But this problem is not going away. Although we've made some very significant steps, it's clear from the numbers that some people just don't get it. On the national level, over the past 15 years, we've seen a significant drop in the number of pre-employment drug test failures. It's dropped from 14% to 5%. However, post-accident remains about 5%. It's a very interesting statistic when you consider the implications. In the Hoffman companies, over the past 2 years, we've had over 1,000 pre-employment failures. Those are large numbers. Even more disturbing is we've had 40 post-accident failures over that two-year period. These are folks that have been involved one way or another in an accident. That's extremely disturbing. you look at those numbers, and what you say is, we must continue our efforts. We must get these numbers down to zero, and to do it, we must send a very clear message. Senate Bill 284 removes any subjectivity and makes it black and white. If you fail a drug test, attempt to subvert a drug test, possess drugs while on an employer's premises, or fail a last chance agreement, you get no benefits. We think that's the right message for those who do not get it, and we ask your support of this bill. If you have any questions, I'm willing to take them now. Ms. Barron's prepared to talk about the details of the bill in some specificity.
Any questions here?
Oh,
wait for a second. Paula, go right ahead. Please introduce yourself. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paula Barron. I'm an attorney. I practice in Portland, and I and my firm represent employers. We work very often with employers attempting to introduce policies, safety policies, drug and alcohol policies. We do considerable training to assist employers in understanding the laws that this body passes or that the Congress passes and help them comply with those. I've been asked to come today to see if I can offer some assistance in just walking through the bill and discussing some of the changes that it makes, some of the proposals that it would introduce, and kind of an underlying structural reason why the changes that are suggested belong in legislation. When the unemployment statutes were originally passed in this state, like many others, they recognized that benefits following the termination of employment were not really a right, but a privilege and a benefit offered to workers who earned them in a sense. The statute has historically had a number of disqualifying acts. For example, if you lied to receive benefits, the state can come back and take your benefits away, and that's a separate disqualification. The statute has also always provided that an employee who is discharged for misconduct in connection with the work is not entitled to unemployment benefits. Again, it's a privilege and not a right. Over the years, there have been a wide variety of circumstances by which an employee can commit misconduct in connection with work. And typically, those circumstances are related either to a fact-based determination in an administrative hearing or occasionally regulations passed by the Employment Department. One thing that developed over the past two decades is the extraordinary increase in the drug and alcohol-related misconduct that occurs on the various workplaces in the United States and in Oregon in particular. Many employees say that they moved to Oregon because they thought drugs were legal in this state based on some old policies that the state had. What happened in response to some of those developments is that the Employment Department passed regulations, and they have currently a drug adjudication policy and an alcohol adjudication policy, which are supposed to outline the circumstances under which an employee will be disqualified from the receipt of benefits. That has proven to be an insufficient way to provide guidance to the agency which must administer the statute. For one, there's always the challenge that the agency exceeded its statutory responsibility in developing this body of law. And second, as Mr. Harmon's testimony indicates, the results from many of those administrative proceedings are highly inconsistent. Accordingly, the suggestion is that the drug adjudication policy and the alcohol adjudication policy, which are now administrative regulation, really belong in a statute that's considered by the legislative body. It needs to keep pace with events that are going on in industry today. The principal change to the statute would be through the Section 9, which would incorporate in many cases those existing administrative policies, but with some additional changes. And I'm going to walk through what those changes are and just briefly highlight. An individual would be disqualified from receipt of unemployment benefits if he or she failed or refused to take a drug or alcohol test as required by the employer's policy. That's current administrative policy. It belongs in the statute where it can be enforced as statute. The proposal would also be to provide that it would be misconduct, disqualifying misconduct, for an employee to refuse to cooperate with or to subvert or attempt to subvert a drug or alcohol test required by the employer's policy. Now, there is some current administrative regulation which relates to that. It is also separately a criminal offense to attempt to subvert a drug test. That's legislation that this body has passed. There are a wide variety of ways employees can attempt to beat drug tests, and there's really quite a subculture. If you were to go and do an internet search and type in pass drug test, you would be presented with thousands of websites which would tell you how to do it, how to dilute your urine, how much water to drink, how much cranberry juice to drink, what sort of substances you could purchase online and take, all with the desire and the design of beating the employment-related drug test. Some of them work, particularly the dilution factor, because you can produce urine that is so dilute it's almost water and no lab can test for the metabolites. The idea being when you go back and you retest, you can be clean. Others are mechanical devices, and they work if you're not caught. Others are chemicals, and they don't work, and people are spending their money to do that. Employees have found that there are other ways of beating a drug test, and that's to refuse to execute documentation. If you were to go in and sign your consent to give a specimen and have that specimen tested and sign your name Donald Duck, you wouldn't present a legal consent, and employees have done things of that nature. You can present false identification, which means that at the end of the day, the employer can't prove that it was your test. So that, if proven, would be a disqualifying act. You wouldn't be entitled to receive unemployment benefits funded by the employer and by the state if you were to do that. It would also be a disqualifying act to adulterate a specimen or to go into a test with an adulterant prepared to use it or to otherwise interfere with the accuracy. It would be disqualifying to be under the influence of intoxicants during work or while you were on the employer's premises. Subject to the employer's policy, then the employees would be aware of the policy. It would be a disqualifying act to have illegal drugs on your body if you were at work, or to test positive. And the testing positive is an important addition because that's really the only objective measure that employers have right now. I mean, it's asking a lot of supervisors on any kind of, say, construction project or in a manufacturing facility to have the requisite expertise to be able to look at an employee and say, I think that you're not fit to work. I mean, we try very hard. If I had an employer who asked me for my advice as a lawyer whether he should try to train his supervisors to do that, I'd go hide under a desk and say, no, you're not trained to do it. You can't become trained to do it. What you really want to try to do is to have objective measures so that you can treat people fairly across the board. There are other provisions in this proposal which would make it a disqualifying act to refuse to enter into a last chance agreement. Now, last chance agreements are something that members of the treatment community and employers trying to get hold of drug and alcohol problems in their workforce have become very familiar with, and they work like this. An employee either self-identifies as having a problem or fails a drug test or commits some sort of drug or alcohol-related misconduct. The employer then presents the employee with the firm hard choice, get well or get out. And the treatment community tells us that that works very well because often the last thing that an addict or an alcoholic will have is the job. So if you take the job away, they can no longer continue to use. And that's often the motivating factor to get into treatment. A last chance agreement is an agreement between the employer and the employee that the employee will seek treatment and in exchange for that won't be terminated but will get his or her job back. An employee who refuses to sign a last chance agreement is generally making the choice to continue using the substances, often the illegal substances, and basically saying, I don't want my job that much. That should be a disqualifying factor. And that is current administrative policy, which this proposal seeks to move into the statute. There are other provisions which are also current administrative policy which would disqualify an employee for refusing to accept available work. Now, the way the statute currently works is if I'm receiving benefits but a job's available for me and I refuse to take it without good cause, I stop receiving benefits, the desire being to at least save the public purse so that people who have reasonable opportunities get back to work actually do get back to work. It is not a good excuse under current administrative policy to refuse to accept a job simply because the employer has a substance abuse policy. So this proposal would bring that into the statute as well. And then there are some provisions which are definitional in nature. They define drug. The statute would replace controlled substance with drug, which would refer back to other provisions of the Oregon statute and how drug is defined. I'd be happy to answer any questions if the committee has any.
Questions? Thank you very much. Before I call up the next panel, Julie, did you have... I had made a commitment to you to, you have another commitment later on this afternoon.
Yes.
You still have that?
Yes.
What I'll do is I will temporarily, we will recess the hearing on 284 and open up a public hearing on 739. Somehow that slipped my mind until I saw you sitting out there.
So funny.
739, do you want to start ahead with this?
Senate Bill 739 bans sale of certain types of goods at unused property market unless person has authorization from manufacturer or distributor. It requires persons to keep records when purchasing new and unused property to sell at unused property markets. Violations punishable as misdemeanors. No revenue impact. We do not have a fiscal statement.
Okay. Panel, committee, this is a companion bill to Senate Bill 466 that was in the Judiciary Committee and passed out of the Judiciary Committee. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That's the...
It hasn't passed out, Mr. Chair, but it is in the Senate Judiciary.
And that's the metal underwear bill. This is a companion bill to the metal underwear bill. The
Judiciary Committee has not passed out yet. Well, that's good.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis. Thank you, Senator Nelson, for that brief description. This is, it does have a companion bill. Senate Bill 739 is what we have termed the flea market bill. Senate Bill 466 is what we've termed the metal underwear bill in the building for this session. And it's my hope that I've at least brought some levity to sometimes a difficult session this year. They really do need to be discussed together because they go hand in hand, and that's why I think if you looked at the number of states that have passed both pieces of legislation, they generally are the same states. Senate Bill 466, although not in your committee, it is in Judiciary, it's getting reworked. It prohibits the use of certain detection devices that shield the electronic article surveillance devices from working. They prevent them from working. What happens is boosters who are professional shoplifters go into the stores and they do what is called a shelf sweep, and they take a great deal of product off the shelf by utilizing a tool such as the metal underwear, or in reality lined coats that are lined with aluminum, or bags that are lined with aluminum, and that again prevents the article surveillance device from triggering when one leaves the store. Boosters operate generally in teams of four or more, so there's not just one person going into a store operating by him or herself. They go in with a group, and so even if the store clerks are watching one person, it's very unlikely that they'll be able to watch all four people. So then the person leaves the store, and then if you look on your green sheet, the product is sold to, of course I used the green sheet for because it's St. Patrick's Day, but the product is then sold into the black market to flea market fences, who pay anywhere from about a quarter to half the retail price. Some of the products that are most frequently stolen, the number one product, about 60% of all product generally falls in the category of baby food or baby formula. I have a one-year-old, and any time I walk down the baby aisle at our local grocery store where my husband and I do our shopping, there would only be one can of Enfamil on the shelf. And the reason is because they lose so much product to these boosters. And so they can't keep it on the shelves, otherwise it will be stolen. So then the other products are like razors that are often stolen. You can go to a flea market here on Portland Road and get a much better deal on a razor than you would pay at retail. So the product is then sold to the flea market fence, then who sells it into the flea market arena. And you can see the flow chart of how the product is then handled. So what we have done in other states, retailers who have become increasingly nervous about this type of trade have really tried to do two things. One, increase the penalties for the people who are doing this professional shoplifting. The second thing they have tried to do is try to put legislation that governs the flea market fences and the flea market sales itself. In other words, they put bans on selling things like Enfamil in the flea market or medical devices that are used in flea market. Another hot item is glucose strips that are often used for testing of diabetes. So those are some of the things that would be prohibited for sale in a flea market under this legislation. And Again, this is something that we have looked, I think 28 other states have passed similar legislation. You'll see it's a good thing to be, you know, state number 29, because you can see the exemptions that we've learned to exempt things like livestock sales, things like that, because once the original legislations that started on in the southern part of the United States were actually too broad, and that was unintended. So I hope that explanation helps why we are here asking for this legislation that is, again, a companion to 466.
Okay. Questions of the committee? So you're defined as a progressive fine. First violation is 30 days, 100,000.
Right.
Second violation, 6 months, 2,000. And third violation is 5,000.
Right.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I don't see any other person signed up for this. I haven't heard any other objections to this bill. So let's just close the public hearing and we'll go into work session. Open up work session on Senate Bill 739. Comments or discussion from the chair, from the committee? Senator Metzger has moved Senate Bill 739 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion, objections? So ordered, and I believe Senator Minnis would like to carry this, since he has the other companion. I will really reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 284, and how about Patrick Green and David... I'm close, aren't I?
Okay. You were signed up first.
Okay. But now that we figured out who's going first, we like to, you know, bargain these things in labor. Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Green with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we are in opposition to Senate Bill 284, and so I'd like to lay out the reasons for that. First off, we think that Senate Bill 284 is unnecessary, that this is an area of the law that's largely settled. Current law and administrative rules are adequate to ensure that workers who impair their work performance on the job due to drug and alcohol use and who lose their jobs as the result of such impairment are not allowed to collect unemployment benefits. That's currently the way things are. You're drunk on the job, you lose your job. Because you're drunk or using drugs on the job, you're not allowed to get unemployment benefits. So that's largely settled. Senate Bill 284, we're on Senate side this time, crosses a line between on-the-job obligations and off-the-job behavior. For example, in Section 10 of the bill, it extends disqualification for unemployment benefits for workers who have already qualified for and are properly receiving their unemployment benefits to tests that are subjective. So, for example, it says that these are reasons, if you look at Section 10, reasons to to disqualify people, that they voluntarily leave work, fail to apply for suitable work. What is suitable work? Because the employer has or introduces a drug-free workplace policy. Now, again, this is someone who's already on unemployment, who's seeking a job with a new employer, that they've avoided taking a drug or alcohol test. Yes.
I'm just confused. You're talking about Section 10. I've only got two sections of this bill.
Subsection 10.
On
page 4.
On page 4.
Section 1.
Starting page 4, line 7.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Thank you. It gives a number of reasons why someone who's already receiving unemployment benefits could lose those benefits. And the question is, in terms of judging this, who is to judge that someone didn't take suitable work because they wanted to avoid taking a drug or alcohol test at that new work, that they did it to avoid being discharged. So The only thing we can think of is that that would be the employment department's. Now, the employment department's job would be to investigate the what is in the minds and motives of unemployed workers regarding future drug tests for new work. Section 9 is also objectionable because it includes disqualification. Now, we're on page 3. Let me see here, get my notes. It has a number of reasons why people could be disqualified, but one of them, for example, is on line 38, that someone could be under the influence of intoxicants during work or while on the employer's premises. So if you're a restaurant worker or a bartender, or you work at a stadium, and you are under the influence of intoxicants, but you're not on the job. I mean, let's say you work at a stadium, you sell beer, it's your night off, you go to a game, and you get, you know, wasted. You're on the employer's premises, but you're not on the job. You're there as a private citizen going and seeing a game. Or under the influence of intoxicants, that's not, you know, that could be any sort of level of intoxication. That seems a little far. So we support existing law, which are and policies which already cover people who abuse drugs on the job. We don't want unsafe workplaces. We recognize that people who are intoxicated on the job are a threat to the health and safety of their coworkers, and we don't think that people who get drunk on the job ought to be there, and they ought to be terminated for it. But what we do oppose is that these sorts of standards that that would disqualify people after they're already lawfully receiving unemployment benefits isn't a good way to go. And then I guess I'll add this last thing, which is on still on line 3, I'm sorry, page 3, line 42 and 43, that if someone tests positive for alcohol or not, or an unlawful drug in connection with employment, including a pre-employment or pre-placement test, could also be disqualified. So essentially what we're doing, somebody could be receiving unemployment, they go to apply for a job, they test positive for something, they could lose their unemployment benefits. So again, that's something that has nothing to do with that is a regulation of off-the-job behavior. Somebody take, you know, that's not a smart thing to do, is to be in a situation to test positive while you're applying for a job. But it is not; it has nothing to do with what they are doing on or off the job. On the job in their employment situation. So that's we have a problem with that. So with that, I can answer any questions, or we could go on to Dave.
Let's go on to Dave and see what's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, also testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 284. And there are a couple of points, maybe 3 points, that I wanted to make today. The first is that the proponents of this bill argue that it's necessary because there have been inconsistent decisions by hearings officers at the employment division level. But they're also arguing that the standards in the current regulations of the employment department are not tight enough and don't reflect their view of what the law should be. By changing the law, they are going to just open the door for more interpretations of these changes that will unsettle what may be currently settled law. The gentleman from Hoffman Construction testified that they'd been involved in 9 or 10 cases, I think, that went on to appeals, and that they won all of those appeals. By passing this legislation, they may have to re-argue many of those same issues. Plus, they will be opening up a number of other issues that are not currently prohibited under the Employment Department regulations. The intent of this bill, as far as we can understand it from the testimony today and the testimony on the companion bill in the House on Friday, is to essentially remove most of the judgment calls in unemployment compensation cases that are related to drug testing. And it's important for this committee to understand what urinalysis drug testing does show and what it doesn't show. Urinalysis does not test for actual presence of unlawful drugs. It uncovers evidence of metabolites of drugs, that is, the byproducts that show up in the urine that may be as a result of unlawful drug use, or maybe as a result of some lawful drug use, that is a prescribed drug, or it may be the result of some other substance altogether, at least in the initial screening. But it does not test for impairment. Unlike a breathalyzer test with alcohol, which correlates directly to the amount of alcohol in a person's system at the time they blow in a machine, as opposed to a blood test, which can detect levels of an actual illegal drug, urine testing does not show the controlled substance itself. It shows the byproducts. And that gets us to the issue of on-the-job versus off-the-job behavior, whether or not the person was, in fact, under the influence on the job or not. With alcohol, it's relatively easy to test for that. With controlled substances, it is very, very difficult. Now, if the state of Oregon wants to take the position that anyone who has at any time ingested unlawful drugs should be disqualified from any employment or should be disqualified from receiving unemployment benefits, you can certainly make that decision. But if you are coupling that decision with the requirement of an individual to submit to a search without any suspicion, then you run straight into the protection against unreasonable searches and seizures in the Constitution. Now, the Constitution, that constitutional protection of privacy against unreasonable searches and seizures, does not apply to private employers. Private employers are not bound by the Constitution, but the government is. And up until now, with current law, although there is the potential of a constitutional challenge being brought, as far as I'm aware, none has been brought. But if you put into statute a provision that says that a person who has lawfully qualified for unemployment compensation, that is, they were laid off from their previous job, there was no misconduct, they are otherwise qualified for unemployment compensation. If the state is going to say in statute that that person must submit to a search in order to continue receiving unemployment compensation, you are then coupling a government benefit with that search. That search, which is carried out by someone else without any suspicion that the individual has done anything wrong. And it is those types of general searches, blanket searches, random searches, suspicionless searches, that the Constitution is designed to prevent the government from carrying out. And I just want to flag for the committee that this potential constitutional issue, which up to now has been avoided, largely because there has been, representatives of employees and employers have reached a somewhat uneasy compromise on drug testing in the workplace in this state. But if you start changing the rules, it makes it much more likely that there's going to be a constitutional challenge to this practice. I think those are the major points I wanted to make this afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fedanke, would you explain for me in the bill so I can follow along? I got your argument, but I'm trying to relate this to the language in the bill. You just spoke about an individual who is otherwise qualified and receiving unemployment benefits, having been dismissed, from another employer, but legitimately receiving unemployment benefits. And now you then talk about, in order to maintain those benefits, going to be subject to an unlawful search. Now, tell me where in this in the bill at that point we reach that.
Because it's in that subsection 10 on page 4, beginning of line 7, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger. And that this relates to a disqualifying act. After the person's already receiving unemployment compensation, they're required by statute, by the current statute, to be looking for suitable work.
Right.
And this bill would impose a standard that the person would be refusing to look for suitable work if they fail to submit to a pre-employment drug test by an employer, failed to apply for a job where random urinalysis testing was the employer's policy, therefore it would be disqualified from continuing to receive unemployment compensation.
No, requiring to take the test to get this job, et cetera, that is commonplace. It's the look back from the previous employer that you say is a constitutional issue, that you may be taking away a benefit that was legitimately earned in previous employment. Not the fact that a new employer might require this, it's just that what it triggers, you think, may be constitutionally problem.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, the issue is how should the requirement for someone currently receiving unemployment compensation to look for suitable work be interpreted? Under current law, that interpretation is something of a judgment call under the statute. One of the effects of this bill would be to eliminate any discretion on the part of the employment department and say that if a current recipient of unemployment compensation refuses to apply for a job where drug testing is required or fails to undergo a urine test, that they would then be disqualified from receiving future benefits, even though the recipient of unemployment compensation may have been acting reasonably in refusing to apply for that job, may have been acting within their constitutional rights in refusing to apply for that job. Let me give you a couple of examples of situations. And keep in mind that both current regulations of the Employment Department and this bill define controlled substances as acts which are illegal under the Oregon Controlled Substances Act. Taking a controlled substance under a doctor's prescription is not illegal. And there are many people who suffer from medical ailments who take prescription controlled substances and may not be impaired on the job as a result of the use of that drug, but may have an ailment that they don't want to disclose to a prospective employer in order to maintain their own privacy. Because it's not relevant to the job. And as long as they're not impaired, they should have that constitutional right, we would argue. And they should not be disqualified from receiving unemployment compensation because they exercise that right of privacy. Now, again, they don't have a right of privacy against a private employer, but they do against the government. And it's the government here that's conditioning that future benefit on them giving up their constitutional right to privacy. That's where we see the constitutional problem. Does that make sense, Senator?
That's one of my questions, Senator. Okay, both you and Patrick have talked about in that terms with reference to subsection 10 of section 1. My question would go back then to subsection 9. Patrick had mentioned the argument about being on an employer's premises and being intoxicated but not while at work. Are there any other issues with subsection 9 that you see that are constitutionally problematic?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I mean, some of these are expressions of current rule or policy, but and so in addition to the employer's premises, I don't know if there's such a if there's necessarily a constitutional issue, or maybe it does link with it, which is the issue of pre-employment or pre-placement tests. That it's not I don't know if that's so much a constitutional issue, but it is something that has nothing to do with how you qualified for benefits in the past, but that again submission. That you would test positive in a pre-employment or pre-placement test, what that has to do with your current receipt of benefits, which you rightfully earned. I don't know, Dave, if you want
Mr.
to get in.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on that again, David Fidanke, ACLU. Subsection 9 of the bill on page 3 in subsection 9B talks about failing or refusing to take a drug or alcohol test as required by the employer's reasonable written policy. In the next subsection also refers to an employer's reasonable written policy. Now, we know what that means in the context of the current Employment Department administrative rules. Not all employer drug testing policies are reasonable under the current rules. We don't know whether under this bill the Employment Division rules would still be valid, the Employment Department rules would still be valid, or whether they would have to be changed. But let me give you just quickly run through some of the caveats of the current administrative rule that this bill might require changing. Number one, the employer would have to have, if they did random or blanket testing, they would have to have a written policy that was provided to employees at the time of their hire, or at least 30 days prior to the testing. But then there's a series of requirements that have to be met, one or the other of these. The employee could or would pose a significant danger to himself or others. The employee could pose a significant threat to public safety. The testing is required by statute or government licensing. These would be generally federal requirements. The nature of the job is inconsistent with the illegal use of drugs at any time, such as police officers, prosecutors, drug rehab counselors. And again, that goes back to the issue of urine tests only testing whether or not the person was exposed to drugs at some time, not necessarily on the job. The job duties are such that the individual, if impaired, could cause the employer significant economic harm, or the testing is conducted pursuant to a reasonable last chance agreement. Now, there are lots of jobs.
We're getting into some a lot of detail here, and we got some more to go here. Are you reasonably satisfied with?
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, what I am. I think we would have to hear from the Employment Department whether this would impact their rules or not, and then I think it would just be a policy decision on that subsection for us. So.
We understand there's an issue here.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say one more thing about this. There are lots of jobs that don't fall within these categories where drug testing may be required and where unemployment compensation would not be disqualified because of a refusal to submit to the testing or to apply for that job in the future. The provision of the bill that we are most concerned about is the provision on page 5, which is subsection 13, sub C, which defines an individual being under the influence of intoxicant as any time the person has a positive urine test. And that is a real problem, because urine testing does not test impairment. It tests drug use, not impairment on the job. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and thank you. And we understand there's some issues here that we'll need to delve into. Thank you very much. We have Jerry Jeswald from Serenity Lane. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you.
Did I get the name right?
I'm impressed. Close enough. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Jeswald, and I...
Jerry, would you want to pull that down a little bit? Just
sure.
Down? I think it's feeding back somewhere. In
the okay. How's that?
I think that's better, yeah.
Okay. I have worked in the treatment field for well over 20 years. I'm also a 26-year recovering alcoholic and drug addict myself. My capacity of work with Serenity Lane is that I'm manager of employer services. I have worked with literally hundreds of employers throughout the state and the country. In addition to that, would not be an exaggeration for me to say that I've had thousands of cases, rather, over the years, 20-plus years. I'd like to just read some of the comments that I wrote in a letter that I sent to AOI, and then I would answer any questions that you might have. Is that feedback coming?
Or? Still feedback a little bit. Push that other one away.
Okay.
You can back up from a little bit.
Too. Okay, that might help. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict of 26 years and have worked in the last 20-plus years helping employers reasonably address this very serious issue in the workplace. As it relates to addiction, there's one thing that motivates someone to change for the positive, and that's discomfort. Allowing someone unemployment benefits after they've disqualified themselves by violating a company's alcohol and drug policy and not accessing treatment does not, in my opinion, provide the type of discomfort that would motivate someone to change. I feel very strongly that alcoholics and addicts should not be discriminated against. I believe just as strongly, however, that they have a responsibility to correct a medical condition that they find themselves experiencing. With the few changes in this bill, I would see this bill as being balanced between respectfully allowing the individual a certain amount of time to access treatment while maintaining some level of accountability related to that decision. By allowing unemployment benefits to individuals who continue to engage in self-destructive behaviors only perpetuates the continuation of such behaviors. Some might argue that withholding benefits would only hurt the family, etc., by taking food out of their mouths. Let me assure you that when people are harmfully involved with drugs or alcohol, they're already doing it. This bill gives the individual the opportunity to avoid such discomfort by making healthier decisions in the form of treatment when appropriate, or some other support network that moves them beyond the destructive patterns of abusing alcohol and other drugs. One of the things that, and I will echo what Dan said earlier from the treatment community, that when last chance agreements are appropriately applied, there's a high percentage of those people that we're able to keep in treatment long enough, assuming that they're tied to a job that they want to keep, that we're able to keep them in treatment long enough to do some good. The one thing that all the data shows that's been done nationally, et cetera, that shows that the longer somebody's in some kind of a structured discipline program of recovery, the higher the likelihood that they're going to succeed in a lifetime of recovery, myself being an example. When I went into treatment, I was a high school health educator. I tell you that simply because I should be ashamed, I guess, but that's kind of the nature of the way drugs and alcohol work. and people make decisions that I think need to motivate them in a direction that's going to hopefully get them in a place where they're more productive in society rather than taking out of society. So with that, I would entertain any questions.
Questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming up, Jerry. Tom Byerly. Byerly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. The department is not taking a position on this bill. For the most part, the bill does codify our current rules and policies that we have in practice, with the exception of just a few areas. Our only real need is to be sure that the intent of the new language is clear so we can strive to achieve the consistency that the proponents are looking for. In walking through the bill itself, in Section 1, Subsection 9, little a, and there's big C, 2 down line 32, we would like some clarification. Are we working with the bill sponsors to understand what the failure to verify the chain of custody would mean? I know the worker has to sign the form, but after the specimen is out of their control, we're not sure how they would be able to track that after that. So we'd like some clarification on that. On further down, line 34 there, and number 4, possession of a known adulterant. We'd like to know specifically what that means and what possession looks like. Does that mean on their person when they go for tests? Does that mean in their home? We'll work with them a little bit on a clarification for that. On down the page in line 42, that'd be big F, we need some more clarification on what connection with employment means. And the pre-employment or pre-placement testing, we're going to need some clarification on that for the simple reason that we often won't know when someone goes to apply for work and then refuses to take a drug test unless we had referred them. So if we haven't referred them, we're not going to know. So we're going to need to set up some sort of a reporting mechanism or have a way that employers can let us know that so we're aware of it. Further, we're not sure how that would impact somebody, as stated earlier, who is currently on unemployment insurance benefits and decides to not take that test, and we don't know about it. So there's got to have to be a way for us to find out. One other area on the next page, in page 4, that we would like some clarification on, and that would be in subsection 10, little d, line 15. It mentions to avoid being discharged for misconduct of any kind. We'd like to get further clarification on what the intent of that is. That's sort of just kind of pops up there a little bit out of context maybe, or we just don't know what the intent is. With that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions if you have any.
Yes, sir.
You heard the testimony of Mr. Fedanke, and then you just said when you started, other than the clarifications you pointed out, this essentially codifies what you do now. So
that's correct.
On these other areas, which you did not talk specifically about, the employment department pretty well does this now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's true. That's in our current policy.
He brought up constitutional issues, but if we're doing it now, then apparently you have found, you know, that has worked for you.
It has worked.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, President. Thank you. There's some work to do on this bill, evidently, so we'll close the public hearing and get you. I'd like to get together with the interested parties here and try and make some clarifications here. Okay, very good. Let's close the public hearing. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 824. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 824 prohibits installation of wired glass in certain locations unless glass meets impact standards and labeling requirements. It requires removal of existing wired glass in certain locations if glass does not meet impact standards and labeling requirements. It establishes a civil penalty and allows compensation to structure owners for cost of removing wired glass contingent on funding. No revenue impact and no fiscal statement at this time.
Okay.
And we have amendments.
Thank you. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Would you like to start?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator Walker and Greg and Jared, table please.
Mr. Chair, members of my committee, I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator for District 7. I'd like to start out by showing you a video that is a short news video from 1983, and follow that up by a very short 30-second shot of a young man flying through wired glass. And the reason I'd like to do that is because for most people, they don't know what wired glass is, but it's you come into the hearing room through the public entrance, you can see it in the vision panel of the door. That's an appropriate location for wired glass. Unfortunately, wired glass for years has been in locations that is inappropriate, and the industry has done very little to make that correction. In fact, the industry has an exemption from safety standards that the Consumer Product Safety Commission established in 1977 about wired glass and the impact standards. The 100-pound impact was not safe enough. It protects about a 5-year-old child. Well, today, here with me is Greg Abel and his son Jared. And Jared, nearly 2 years ago now, or over 2 years ago now, impacted wired glass at the University of Oregon. And often we find it is young adults playing basketball. Wired glass is everywhere. Once you know what it is, you will see it everywhere. And it is horrific, the injuries that it inflicts upon people. So let me run this, and I'm not too good of a technophobe, but it is queued up. And the power is on. This is a story from 1983 in Chicago, so they...
Our top story on Eyewitness News at 5, an exclusive report by our Target 7 team on a type of glass that is supposed to be safe, but apparently causes injuries and a great deal of money to replace. Eyewitness News reporter Roberta Baskin is here with the results of another Target 7 investigation.
Joel, when a product is called a safety material, we expect it to be safe. Well, Target 7 found a type of glass labeled as safety glass. It even looks stronger than regular glass. It is anything but.
Wire glass. It gives the illusion that it's as strong as steel.
And what's the reality?
The reality is it's less strong than ordinary glass and more likely to cause injury than ordinary glass, and certainly not as safe as safety glazing such as tempered glass.
Wire glass is everywhere. You see it in gymnasiums, in schools, park buildings, even parking garages. But no one is more aware of the consequences of wire glass than those who have suffered maiming injuries. Brad Meyer, 21 years old. His arm had to be amputated at the elbow. He had been playing basketball in a gym where there was wire glass. Pat Soptic, 17 years old. His arm has permanent nerve damage. He was walking out of school and his arm went through the wire glass door. Basil Blaney, at 15, his arm became paralyzed. He was leaving school. And John Parrish, at 26, he lost half the use of his right hand. He was playing basketball when he learned how fragile wire glass really is.
I was in the process of trying to retrieve a rebound that had gone over my head and saw that I couldn't retrieve the ball. My momentum was almost stopped, and I put my hands up to stop me completely. And as I put my right hand up, it hit the pane of glass in the door.
How much pressure did you put on that wire glass?
It was very minimal. I think that was the one thing that surprised me. It gave way very easily. My arm went all the way through. That was the amazing thing. I could see my arm go. It was almost like it was in slow motion.
The wire glass cut Parrish's arm so severely, he almost died from the loss of blood. Because of his disability, he has learned to do everything left-handed.
Things that people take for granted, you just can't do it. You have to learn to do it different ways, and that was a pretty big adjustment.
One reason wire glass is used so much is its ability to stand up to fire. inside areas like this, it's necessary under fire codes because under extreme heat, glass explodes. So in a fire, the wire literally acts as a net, keeping the glass from flying in different directions.
Wire glass is required in school hallways if glass is used. It's also called for in fire doors like this one. But it is rarely needed in doors that open to the outside, like the door where John Parrish ripped up his arm. Target 7 found numerous places where wire glass is a hazard, not a fire prevention device. The wire glass serves no purpose whatsoever. At Chicago's McFetridge Sports Arena, we asked why doors and windows were covered with wire glass from top to bottom.
It's a safety glass is what it is. The thing is that if anybody, especially a lot of these people coming in and out of here, somebody should go bump into the glass in there. It prevents them from going through the glass.
Many people think wire glass stops vandals. Almost everyone thinks it's one of the strongest types of glass around. But at the Illinois Institute of Technology, we set up a safety test which shatters that illusion. Engineering expert Dr. Lawrence Broutman compared the strength of wire glass with tempered glass, which is specially treated. Both are identical in price, but not in strength. The punching bag shows what would happen if a person walking fast hit the glass panel. The tempered glass did not break. The wire glass shattered, exposing razor-sharp wires that trap the bag as they would a person's arm or leg.
Wired glass is approximately half as strong as just an ordinary piece of plate glass, and it's only about a tenth as strong as the conventional tempered strengthened glass.
We showed the test to Neil Rostdeutscher, director of buildings for Schaumburg District 54. It's the largest elementary school district in Illinois.
I'm astounded. I did know that tempered glass was stronger, but I didn't think it was that much stronger than wired glass. The experts should get this point across to the people that make the codes and the laws so that this can be corrected.
The danger posed by wire glass can be reduced. Where wire glass is required to prevent the spread of fire and smoke, it can be covered with steel grating, like here at the Loyola Park District Fieldhouse. Public awareness of wire glass hazards can also help.
I'm not saying don't, you know, when you see a pane of wired glass, run away because you're about to experience something like I have. But at the same time, you have to realize the hazards that are associated with it and change your behavior accordingly.
7 years ago, the Consumer Product Safety Commission did restrict the use of wire glass, but opposition from the glass industry and the hodgepodge of state and local fire codes has left a lot of confusion. Today, federal rules only require wire glass in fire doors. State and local safety codes allow wire glass in virtually all other areas. The result is that wire glass is widely used where it shouldn't be, with consequences like those that we've shown you today. Marianne and Joel?
Well, I'm amazed, as everyone I'm sure you talked with is, because it must be more cosmetic than we've been sold on the image of it being strong.
Exactly. It's the illusion of safety. And one other thing that I'd like to mention is that as wire glass gets older, it gets weaker because any moisture that gets into those wires corrodes it even further and it breaks down the glass.
Thank you, Roberta.
Yeah, I share your thought. I mean, I always thought that would stop you from going through. You know, the wire wouldn't break.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your attention. Now, some things have changed since then. We don't need to put up steel grating on these windows to protect them. There is safety foam that can be applied to existing structures. But these folks raise some really interesting questions, and certainly the testing is a lot more sophisticated than that. My constituent can tell you that he has tested this glass twice in independent testing labs, and it has failed to even meet the minimum standard. But what the gentleman from the school district said was really telling. He said experts should get the message across to people who make the codes and laws. And that's what we're here today to show you. And what I'm going to show you now is a young man who had a basketball scholarship to BYU, Brigham Young University, in the final playoff game. Local TV station was there. Bright basketball player. He's running down the court, and he's blocking a shot, and he keeps on running. And at the end of the court is an entire wall of wire glass
This young man goes through that wall. Now, I don't know about you, but that scared the bejesus out of me when I saw that. I don't know if I can make this play again. Is Brett Kerman. 2 weeks after my constituents son, Jared, impacted wired glass at the University of Oregon, Brett Terman's basketball career ended. The college scholarship that he had to BYU was withdrawn. The young man has very little function of his arm. I believe Mr. Abel can talk to you about that. But that isn't the only case of wired glass harming children and young adults. We have them in Oregon. I've given you a copy of a booklet that Greg has put together, Mr. Abel's put together, Wired Glass, The Illusion of Safety. I've highlighted some green tabs for you, and some of you may be weak in the stomach and can't don't want to look at these photos, but I suggest that you do. The first tab that you will see is the injury data that my constituent has put together, and since he's put together this book, the injury data has grown substantially because he's put together a nonprofit website that is telling the world about wired glass. And we get calls all the time. We get emails. Just in November of this year, Pedro Valenzuela, a little 12-year-old boy in Eugene, impacted wired glass in the school and has now had two surgeries. On the very day that Mr. Abel and I were testifying in front of building codes 2 weeks ago on this issue, a junior at Southern Oregon State University was on his way to the restroom for the physics lab, and he put his hand on the door and his other hand on the wired glass, and his hand went right through the glass. That is not uncommon. As was indicated in the news clipping, a wired glass gets weaker as it gets older. It is actually inherently weak when it is put together, and you will see that at one of the other tabs. The second green tab that you have shows the photographs of Jared Abel after his injury at the university. It also shows Blaney, who was on the video. Mr. Blaney's arm is just useless. And then it begins the stories at the next tab, and there are several stories in here, and one will just make you cry. Cindy Neville, they all make you cry. It's frightening to see what happens to these people. But Cindy Neville wrote about her son, Dave, who was going to Wilsonville High School, senior star basketball player, February 4th, 2000. That young man impacted wired glass. 29 physical therapy appointments later, in addition to the surgery, he no longer is ever to play basketball again. The third green tab, you will see an article that talks about the engineering properties of glass. And this booklet is just full of information. I've provided you also with an update. Mr. Abel has updated you with some information, and you may think this is information overload, but I found it absolutely fascinating to read about wired glass. Additionally, I've given you a copy of a letter, a memo I sent to Congress asking for congressional hearings on this matter because I believe there has been fraud committed by the wired glass manufacturing industry, and a letter to the Consumer Product Safety Commission acting chair at that time demanding to know why the Consumer Product Safety Commission failed to follow up on the issue in 1977. In 1977, the industry was granted a 2.5-year exemption to come up with a safer version of their glass. The industry, of course, as it always does, took the CPSC to court. The court threw it back to CPSC and said, hey, tell us why you're only giving these people 2.5 years. They've made a case that they can't do this in 2.5 years. CPSC did nothing. They did absolutely nothing. And the industry has enjoyed this exemption from safety standards for almost 30 years. They've been able to sell this stuff on the cheap. They have a huge market share because no other safety glazing material has this safety exemption. There are only 4 manufacturers of wire glass. They make the whole world supply of wire glass. 3 in Japan, 1 in the United Kingdom. And members of my committee and those in the audience, let me tell you that the United Kingdom does not put the same kind of wire glass in its facilities that they sell over here. They have a different standard for their folks in their country than what we have here. So I am frankly appalled. The American National Standards Institute has been the one to oversee wired glass and its exemption from safety standards. We have here with us today to testify Kate Steele, who's a member of that ANSI Z97.1 committee. And I feel that they've not done their job. I have written a letter to them as well. And I'd like my constituent to talk to you about where he's gone with this issue since his son was sent to the hospital, and Greg received a call about that incident.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to be here today. Little did I know, a little over 2 years ago, where my journey would take me after having received a phone call from one of my son's fraternity brothers asking me where and how we would like Jared to be transported to Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. On my arrival to Sacred Heart and entering the emergency room, my son was laying there being attended to, and he looked up at me and he said, Dad, just remember everything happens for a reason. And that is part of the reason why I am here today. That happened on Super Bowl Sunday 2 years ago, January 28th. The following Monday, I was on the phone to local code officials to have a better understanding or to have them explain to me how it would be that a product such as wired glass that broke with such dangerous characteristics could be in areas that were subject to human impact. It was explained to me that it's the code. And as we got into it's the code, it was explained to me that there was a temporary exemption from CPSC compliance for impact safety. As I got into it further and discussing with the state's building code here in Salem, it was explained to me that there was a temporary exemption from impact standards that had been granted to the wire glass manufacturers some 25 years ago, approximately 30 years ago now. I began going to the International Code Council hearing, offering testimony as to the hazards of wired glass, and found in talking to code officials all over the United States and different managers of sports facilities and code officials that there was this illusion that wired glass was a safety glazing, and that the steel or the wire in the glass was related to as rebar in concrete, that it actually made it stronger. Well, in fact, the wire in glass actually makes it weaker, not stronger. Wired glass has one half the strength of regular annealed glass. At the point of manufacturing, when the wire is introduced into the glass, it causes stress planes and fractures in the glass. And as the glass gets older, it does become weaker if it is not sealed properly to where moisture can get into the glass, into the wire. I contacted, after having testified before the International Code Council, actually participated in an ad hoc committee that was formed by the International Code Council to study the hazards of wire glass. I had contacted OSBI, the Ontario School Board Insurance Exchange, up in Ontario, Canada, because we found that the United States had very little data with regard to wired glass injuries. The NICE emergency reporting to CPSC is a sampling of injuries that take place in emergency rooms at just approximately 100 hospitals throughout the United States. And we found that even though in the year of 1997, if there were 197,000 injuries related to architectural glazing, not one of those injuries showed up as wired glass, because there is not an E-code or a specific code to identify wired glass from all the other types of glazing. So OSBI, or in Ontario, their risk managers had noticed some time ago an alarming number of wired glass injuries. So they actually started tracking these injuries. And I have a report in front of me, as you do also, from OSBI, where in the Ontario School Board area, they had, from 1987 to the year of 2000, 107 claims with regard to architectural glazing. I spoke with the administrator to OSBI this morning in Ontario to find out exactly what percentage of those glazing injuries actually were wired glass. And there were between 60% and 70% of those 107 injuries. But the point that I would like to make is the cost of those 107 injuries were $3,154,202. Approximately $30,000 per injury is what was paid out with regard to those injuries. And that was did not take into account litigation or suits that also followed. In tracking injuries here, I mean, in Oregon, it has been by word of mouth. One person, you'll talk to them, they'll say, you know, I knew nothing about wired glass or the dangers of until my son was injured. And when I mentioned something to someone, they referred me to another individual that had been injured. And so it's been very difficult to actually ascertain the number of injuries related to wired glass. I am the founder of Advocates for Safe Glass. It's made up of parents of injured parties. We're a nonprofit organization here in the state of Oregon. Advocates for Safe Glass had Dr. Philip Greitzer. He is one of the former founders of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. He is now retired from CDC and is the associate professor of public health at Rawlings School of Public Health at Emory University. And we asked Dr. Greitzer if he could do a study for us, because he is an expert in the field of epidemiology. We asked Dr. Greitzer if he could do a study to identify approximately in elementary education alone how many injuries we had per year. Through the information that he obtained through the Consumer Product Safety Commission, he actually monitored or viewed 6,500 architectural glazing injuries that were related to doors and windows in elementary education in a one-year period. Out of that 6,500, he found that conservatively, 2,400, almost 2,500 injuries were related to wired glass in elementary education alone in our nation. And that was a conservative. There is also a copy of that in your handout. We had concerns as to whether or not wired glass would in fact comply with a Z97.1 standard, the American National Standards Institute. I had wired glass independently tested at a test lab in Fresno, California, approximately 2 years ago, and found it was actually 922, and found that wired glass did in fact fail the impact standard, the minimum impact standard that it claims that it complies with. We again invited the current chair at that time of ANSI Z97 after having expressed our concerns. The former chair of Z97 was John Kent. We asked John Kent, after we expressed our concerns, to pick any test lab in the United States, any accredited test lab. We would take wired glass off the open market, have it shipped to that test lab, if he would accompany us there to see as to whether or not it did comply with the standard that he was the chair of that particular committee. Mr. Kent picked Cortland, New York. I don't know if that was because that's probably the furthest point from Eugene, Oregon that you could possibly have in the United States, but nevertheless, we obliged him and went to Cortland, New York. The test reports show that there was non-compliance to the ANSI Z97 test. The conclusion of that test report says, based on the results presented above, the specimens tested did not demonstrate their compliance to ANSI Z97.1. Now, I have a real problem with how it is, you know, I mean, that a dangerous product can be offered a temporary exemption for 2.5 years, and it continues to exist 30 years later. We have two years in a row, the International Code Council Structural Committee, through code change proposals, has voted to recommend the removal of this temporary exemption. Both times, Mr. Zaremba, the attorney of record for the wire glass industry, has appealed those decisions based on technicalities, not on merit, but on technicalities only. As far as if there are alternative products to wired glass, there are. The price has been dropping. Wired glass has 85% of the fire-rated market in the United States. So it's somewhat difficult for four companies that have 15% of the market between them to be price competitive. But even at that, the price is dropping, and there are alternative products that do not pose an additional burden to the taxpayers. Thank you.
Jared, introduce yourself, please. That was Greg Abel, by the way.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Jared Abel, and I am, I guess, somewhat of the reason you are here before us today. Although my injury took place in a basketball court facility, I have had the opportunity, due to my injury and due to my dad's involvement, to speak with injured parties that have been injured in apartment complexes, in fraternities, in sororities, just walking down the hallways of the schools. And the thing that's most disheartening to me is you have young children who don't understand what's taking place here today. I'm a little bit older, and I can accept the fact that I was injured, and now we are taking steps to hopefully not injure any more children. But the little kids who have to be explained that they don't have an arm anymore and that for the rest of their lives they are not going to be able to tie their own shoes and that they are not going to be able to brush their teeth the same way, for a little child to have to go through that, and for a little girl who her only dream is to grow up to be the next Miss America, for her face to be to have it go through wire glass, it makes you sad. And I'm fortunate, though, that I was probably the least injured out of all of the people that my dad has found. I don't know if someone, if there's a trade-off there. I was the least injured, and my dad is the one that got most involved with that. But I thank whoever's in charge for allowing me to be the least injured. When you have Brett Terman, a basketball player, give up everything that he's ever known in the sports world, give up his scholarship, or actually have his scholarship taken away, it leaves you wondering why things haven't been changed prior to this. I don't have a lot other to say other than coming from an injured party and having met other injured parties. This affects affects your everyday life, and it affects the way you look at yourself, and it affects the way that people look at you. And it's difficult to explain to a young child with that cannot use his right or left arm why everybody looks at him funny, because he has to do everything a little differently than everybody else does.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, I forgot to explain to you what the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments do. Let me just very, very briefly explain that to you. The Dash 1 makes some technical changes to the bill, and the Dash 2 adds the term retrofitting in the section of the bill that talks about removal or retrofitting of glass in existing structures. That was always our intent. It just somehow did not make it into the original draft. I can also tell you I've been in discussion with Mark Long, the director of the Building Codes Division, and he's going to testify today about his concern about putting the new construction issue in statute. The Building Codes Division cannot deal with existing construction. It's outside of their purview. But we've been working with them for almost 2 years on changing the building codes for new construction, and we're almost there. Mr. Long will talk about that. Secondly, I do want to tell you there's a letter from the University of Oregon and also from the School District 4J talking about their efforts to mitigate wired glass. And if I knew how to use this, I would put up on the screen the injury data. But members of the committee, in this booklet here, there is injury data that will tell you things like 200 and 250 stitches to someone's face, part of his chin and nose had to be reattached, 140 stitches due to multiple lacerations to the stomach, the eye, arms, shoulders, and nose. It's horrifying. This is something that happens all the time. And one of the things that I'm going to ask today when I take my place up there is how the industry can keep putting out a product like this that is clearly unsafe, and how they can continue to justify that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your testimony. Appreciate your coming up. We have Tom Newborn, Thomas Zaramba, and Jeffrey Johnson. Come from great distances, evidently. Welcome, gentlemen. Appreciate you taking the time to come from great distances to come here. And
thank you, sir.
Just introduce yourself for the record, where we're going to start.
Chairman Nelson and committee, I am Tom Mewburn, and I represent the wire glass manufacturers. On my right is Jeffrey Johnson, and on my left is Thomas Zaremba, and both would like to speak as well as myself.
Sure.
I am the Director of Technical Service for AFG Industries, and have been in the glass industry my entire career. I'm also a member of the ANSI committee, the GICC committee, which is the Glazing Industry Code Council, and GANA, G-A-N-A, which is the Glass Association of North America. Wire product is a product that is a balancing act between impact and fire resistance. ANSI, which is the committee that provides the test standard for the product, has a test standard for all kinds of products that are used in impact arenas. Tempered products, laminated products, plastic products, and wire glass. The standard sets up the procedure, the equipment that is to be used, and the type of steps to go through the procedures. excuse me. Wire glass has been used in the past 100 or so years in the correct application. The video that was shown previously shows an impact test which was provided by the TV station, which is an incorrect test. I have a video which I would like to show at some point in this discussion that will show you the correct procedure, which I will also narrate because there's no sound with it. As far as the series of injuries, the wire industry is very familiar with this and very aware of it. We have made attempts through the code bodies to try to get regulation and have been successful in changing the use of wire glass. I was a member of the ad hoc committee, the same as Mr. Abel. GICC provided for the International Code Council a code change. The ad hoc committee provided code changes, and the results of those were that in athletic facilities, in the current building codes, you cannot use wire glass. In athletic facilities are facilities where any kind of activity is done. The same thing in school systems of K through 12. So there has been some move on the side of the wire manufacturers to try to correct some of these instances. However, on the other side, where fire is of great concern and the life safety issue enters, wire provides a very, very safe product for life safety. I would like to show you the impact test on the video. Dim the lights, please, if possible. This is an ANSI Z97 impact test. The frame that
where the building codes have determined that in the event of a fire, a corridor needs to be secure from smoke, flame, and hot gases in order to enable building occupants to safely get out of the building before even perhaps the fire department arrives. After, of course, the fire department arrives, typically those fire personnel have to get inside the building, and they typically use those same exit corridors, have now become entry corridors for the fire department. And in order to accomplish this, doors like the doors in this very hearing room typically require, one, fire-rated assembly doors, which, for example, if a fire were to break out in this room, fire alarms would go off, people would begin to exit out the hallway outside this room. That wired glass and the doors that they are in would contain the fire so that people who were exiting through the exit corridors wouldn't be overcome with smoke, hot gases, or flame. That is principally the life safety fire issue that wired glass addresses. In respect to its life safety function in fires, it is extremely safe. It's well proven to be able to resist extreme heat, 1500 degrees, for a very long period of time, 45 minutes, and then afterwards even withstand a hose string test, a fire hose string test. And typically adding cold water to the heat of glass after it's been in a furnace would result in it being shattered. But wired glass is able to pass those very rigorous fire tests. In addition, it has self-healing characteristics. As you saw in one of the tapes, after glass is heated to, for example, 1,000 degrees or more, it will crack. Wired glass has the unique characteristic where during that heating process, the wire in the glass holds the glass in the frame, and the glass actually begins to heal itself, that is, melt and close the gaps that have created from the cracks, so that, again, smoke, hot gases, and flame don't escape the room that you're attempting to contain the fire. The legislation before you, the proposed legislation, is really at odds with all the existing model building codes. And one of the reasons that is true is that it has been amended this just before the hearing to suggest, instead of necessarily replacement in all cases, it suggests retrofitting. And you heard during the testimony of some of the other people who are proponents of the bill that this retrofitting would be a very simple matter because it can simply be done through the application of an applied film. I am also a member of a task group that has been formed by a joint group of glazing members, manufacturers, distributors, and others, and also film manufacturers who would be supplying the film that was mentioned earlier that would be used in this retrofitting of wired glass. And there are numerous unresolved issues. The truth is that film on the application of an exterior surface of glass has never before been put through fires. And so the film industry, like the glazing industry, has a lot of unanswered questions about how will that work. One thing that film does as soon as it's exposed on the unexposed side, if, for example, these wired glass panels in the doors to this chamber were filmed on the outside in the hallway, and a fire broke out in this room, the film on the other side would very likely go absolutely black and go almost immediately when subjected to the heat of the fire, char black. And it would stay black for a number of minutes, no one knows how long, after the fire has begun. One of the things that is being discussed by various NFPA individuals that I've talked to following this disastrous nightclub fire in Rhode Island is that why weren't all of the exit doors being used? Everybody went to one exit door, and that's where a lot of the people were succumbed to the smoke and the fire and conflagration of that fire. Some of the suggestions that are being made is that they couldn't see through the doors, the other exit doors. And in a fire situation, people don't want to exit through doors they can't see what's on the other side. As a result, one of the things that's unanswered in the use of applied films is, what are people going to do if the film chars black, as it does? It's an organic, and it will char black. Firemen won't be able to see in if there's anyone laying on the floor succumbing to smoke. They'll have to open the door. You all know what happens when you open doors where there's a fire on the other side. Oftentimes it can create a backdraft into the exit corridor where people are trying to use that corridor to escape. I have a whole list of litany of questions that neither the film industry nor the glass industry has adequate answers to before we start slapping film all over existing facilities where wired glass is found. For example, it's foreseeable that these applied films can be damaged through everyday use. Films can easily be torn, cut, damaged by exposure to sunlight, heat, cold, water, or even cleansers. Will marred or damaged film perform as expected in a fire or when impacted? No one knows yet. To my knowledge, no testing has been done to answer those types of questions. So from the standpoint of applied films and retrofitting using those, there are some very serious questions that I have not seen adequate answers to. I don't believe the film industry yet has adequate answers to, such that a recommendation could be made that we'll just start retrofitting by applying applied films all over wire glass. Part of the reason that, and I know this is a question that Senator Walker alluded to, was why are these things there? Why is there wire glass where wire glass is found? Well, when the CPSC enacted 16 CFR 1201, which was a national federal standard to regulate glazing used specifically in doors, like those door leafs that you see to the leading to and from the chamber here, that was in 1977 that they were enacted. Many institutions, for example, schools, are much older than that. I have indications that, for example, the mean age of schools in the United States is 42 years old, and that some 46% of the existing schools in this country were built between 1950 and 1969. Now, that was before the CPSC enacted 16 CFR 1201. As a result, there are glazings which predate, were installed long before the CPSC acted in 1977. Many of the injuries that you saw in these lists that are being produced perhaps occurred before relating to installations that predated the CPSC enactment. As a result, you really can't suggest that the industry has had taken some action that has resulted in that. The CPSC determined that it would not apply its legislation retroactively. So that until, for example, there's been a a rebuilding of many, many buildings and current codes are applied, there will be electrical glazing and lots of other construction type issues that relate to older buildings dating back to the 50s and the 60s. It probably doesn't extend only to glass, but I'm sure it applies to lead, the use of lead in plumbing, electrical issues under the NEC, and lots of other issues for older buildings. As building codes develop, there are changes that bring about good and safer uses.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I hate to interrupt, but there's about 8 minutes left. There are some people here who flew out here to testify as well. You've had a great deal of time. I'd love to sit here and interrogate you for 3 hours. Unfortunately, I can't even do that. But I would like it to ask Mr. Chair if we could do something about the situation so that everyone who's come from long distance can testify.
Okay, well, yeah, these gentlemen have come from long distance too, so.
Right.
We got a little cut to time here, but
yeah. Let me just add one thing, Mr. Chairman. If their example, hypothetically, are 1 million or 2 million square feet of wired glass in buildings in the state of Oregon, you have to retain professional surveyors to determine whether this stuff needs to be replaced if this legislation were enacted. You would have owners be required then to seek building code permits to replace it and to modify their buildings. You would have to have architects or engineers specify replacement products. Then you'd have to retain others to come in, remove the glass, replace the glass, or do something else with the glass. You'd then have to have building inspectors come out and determine whether or not it met code before it was approved. At bottom, you're going to have a cost per square foot of $20 to $100. They're looking at least $20 to $40 and perhaps as much as $100 to $200 million to implement what is being proposed in this legislation. Thank you.
Senator Nelson, Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Jeff Johnson. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I am currently representing the product manufacturers in a lawsuit that has been filed in United States Federal District Court in Eugene on behalf of Jared Abel. This case was filed earlier this year. I'm here to speak to a couple of key issues concerning the allegations and also to talk just very briefly about the legislation. I'm a native-born Oregonian, born and raised in East County, Portland, and I've also spent some time working for Oregon OSHA, and I think I have some practical
practical experience in terms of administering codes from an administrative agency level. First, let me state that glass in and of itself is not inherently dangerous. The wire glass is not inherently dangerous. We have some legal standards that we need to be applying to this lawsuit, and I would respectfully suggest that that this legislature should not try to drive what happens in a federal lawsuit that's been filed by the Able family. It is certainly their right. Certainly the injury to Jared, who I've not seen before, is serious. It's regrettable. And it's good to see that he's got such a great attitude in light of the injury that he sustained. And all of those things will have to be decided. But this bill will outlaw all wire glass. Make no mistake about that. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. We're going to take out every piece of wire glass the way this thing is written. And the economic impact on this state is going to be monumental. There is certainly no need for this legislation at this current time. There are other ways to get to the end, and that is to have more safe places for our kids to play and to go to school. And for me, I played hoops in that very same gym when I went to the University of Oregon. And certainly we need to strive to find more safety wherever it is that we play and recreate and educate. But this bill is a bad idea. The emergency clause that is in the bill is negated by the fact that you have until 2012 to implement. And so you have to ask the question, well, if it is such an exigent situation, if there are so many injuries, then why do we have until 2012 to implement it? I, too, like Senator Walker said, would love to do some interrogation on those statistics, and I'm going to get that opportunity in the course of the litigation. I have a lot of questions in terms of fact matching and whether or not these statistics that we've heard, which in court would probably not be admissible because it's all hearsay, but we'll get a chance to interrogate that. But what I would submit to you is that this bill lacks any alternative. Let's take out the wire glass, but what are we going to do in as an alternative? Even Mr. Abel says, well, there are other alternatives. What are they? Is it film? And what about the cost? And what about the risk to the firefighters and the fire safety issue? These are all balancing considerations. So where should that balancing process take place? Should it take place in the Oregon legislature, where we have an economic impact on an order of magnitude of $100 million when you really think about what it's going to take and why you have to have 2012 to be able to implement this? Those are factors that this committee and this legislature should consider. Who should be in the best position to balance all the very technical factors? I would submit it should be the agency. And the agency, the Building Code Agency, has taken this under consideration. The fact is that not everybody is under the thumb of the industry. The letter that was submitted by Senator Walker does talk about some very important points. And the letter of April 3rd, 2002 to her states that eliminating the exemption could seriously impair the ability of building constructors and owners to comply with mandatory fire safety regulatory requirements at the federal, state, and local level. And Ms. Walker, you know, cited a number of Senator Walker cited a number of cases, but the Consumer Product Safety Commission respectfully disagreed with her. All right. Now, that doesn't mean that Senator Walker doesn't have some excellent points, because obviously we've seen some videotapes that show some excellent points. But where should that discussion take place? And I would respectfully submit that discussion should take place at the agency level, and it should not be taking place here. Because if you do adopt some form of this legislation, and the technicians, the scientists, decide that a better alternative is something other than what this legislation proposes, what then are we going to do? Is this body the best place to have a meaningful, intellectually honest discussion about the scientific, fire safety, life safety balancing considerations? And the fact that we're being asked to hurry up with our remarks indicates just how frustrating this process is. But we do respect the proposal. It is being carefully analyzed, but we respectfully submit that this is, in light of the cost and the lack of an alternative, this is not a good piece of legislation at this point in time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick question, sir.
Very quick, Mr. Chair. It's truly unfortunate we're out of time. Mr. Johnson, I would suggest that you read the bill. You have not done so because it does not get rid of all wire glass. It only gets rid of wire glass in athletic facilities and places of hazardous locations where humans will impact it. So please read the bill.
If I may respond, Senator, that's with due respect. The provision talks about foreseeable human impact, mm-hmm. and foreseeable under case law in this state. And as one of the attorneys who argued to the Oregon Supreme Court, one of the three Fazzolari cases, which are the seminal cases on foreseeability in this state, anything is possible. And so if I was to exit this door and trip and fall, as I could, and put my hand through that window, that's a foreseeable impact. It's not limited to athletic facilities as drafted. That may be your intent, but that's not the way it's drafted.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm not going to ask more questions because Ms. Kate Steele can respond to some of the misrepresentations or representations that were made, however you take them.
Thank you.
Further questions? Kate Steele. Thank you, gentlemen. Welcome, Kate. Introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Senators. Excuse me, I'm getting over a bit of the flu, so hopefully you will be able to understand my remarks. I am a member of the ANSI Z97 committee. I'm not by any means representing the committee as a whole, but I would like to share what has happened to the ANSI Z97 committee, which is, as
your name and address.
So Kate Steele. Kate Steele, I represent O'Keefe's Incorporated, which is an alternative fire glazing manufacturer.
Where?
In San Francisco, California. I've been sitting on the ANSI Z97 committee for several years now. ANSI Z97 is a performance specification standard for safety glazing. It's not just a test method. And this committee has been struggling with this wire glass issue for several years. And part of the problem has been is that the committee has not been balanced as required by the ANSI rules, and it has been dominated by the wire glass industry. In 1998, it almost dissolved following a subgroup hearing in which negative comments submitted on behalf of O'Keefe's challenging the 100-foot-pound test were submitted, and in a motion formulated by Mr. Zaremba on behalf of the wire glass industry, discussion was shut down. Following that meeting, and that is an absolute violation of ANSI rules, following that meeting, the chair resigned, the secretary resigned, and the secretariat resigned. About a year and a half later, GICC, which is a trade association, again dominated by wire glass interests or their suppliers or partners in other business endeavors, came back and proposed a new organization to become secretariat, which ANSI requires. That was an organization called GISC. The members of the board of directors are Mr. Zaremba and Mr. Mewborn, one member of Ghana, and two position members. That is domination by the wire glass industry. We have tried to have this issue voted by the full committee following information that was submitted to the about the test injuries, test data, and the injuries that Mr. Abel has presented, and we presented to the ANSI Z97 committee. That was delayed for 2 years by the secretariat, again, which the wire glass industry dominate. Finally, after 2 years, we got another ballot by the full committee, and that committee came back finally, after we're allowed to vote, with a vote of 17 members against having the 100-foot-pound standard, 11 members in favor of it, mainly the wire glass members and their suppliers or business partners, and then there were 8 abstentions. That is a problem that's happened with this committee, is they have not been able to take the sides that they want to take, and that be the side of public safety. That did not achieve the 2/3 required that ANSI requires for the passage of the amendment of a standard that is going out to be revisited. The members get a chance to change their vote. Hopefully we will get another 5 votes and the ANSI Z97 committee will finally do what it needs to do in terms of saying the 100-foot-pound is not a safety standard. Wire glass is not a safety glass. I don't know if we have the overhead projector that works, but I will simply...
I don't know how to use it. Perhaps our technician in the back of the room? It's very simple.
What do you have? Right there. Okay.
Point your attention to this glass right here. Central Glass is one of the, Mr. Newman also represents the Flat Glass Manufacturers Association of Japan as a member of the NCC 97 committee. Central Glass is a member of the Flat Glass Association. This is what Central Glass says about polished wine glass.
Can you read that, Ms. Thiel?
You want to read it to us?
Under safety precautions. It's an, actually a number of glasses on it. It says, the building designers are responsible for incorporating specific characteristics for wire glass and determining the optimal locations and area for the glass. The primary feature of polished wire glass, diamond and cross mesh, is its fire resistance. These glass products are not safety glazing materials and should not be used as such or in locations where human impact is possible or where safety glazing is required. However, there is some use of polished wire glass if building regulations require or permit it for such application.
It is correct that wire glass is a fire-rated product. It's not the only fire-rated product. Since the last 1977, there are many other products now on the market. To give you an example where there has been a level playing field, in Europe, the product market ratio is about the opposite of it is here. And you have the alternative products actually dominating more of the market than the wire glass. And I submit that would happen here, too, if it was a level playing field. The film discussion has, I don't think is accurate, but I'd like to first of all talk to you about the go through the carbonization that Mr. Severin described. It has been tested. Let me tell you, first of all, it has been tested to the mandatory fire test standards that are required by the building codes. There is a wire glass product now listed with film on it for new construction. The question that the industry, the film industry, and then the wire glass industry is talking about is what to do with aftermarket applications. But the laboratory that has tested this and listed the new product has said the film does not affect the fire performance. The carbonization, it will slough off, and what Mr. Zarem didn't say, it will slough off in a fairly short amount of time. And when you say that the people are afraid to go into, look beyond, it's actually, NFPA has done studies, and it's the exact opposite. They are afraid to go in when they see a fire. So that's not actually an accurate statement. I think I don't know that I have any more questions.
I have one question, Mr. Chair. Ms. Steele, I thought it was really interesting that Mr. Johnson said what we need is more safe places for people to play. Can you tell me, on your experience, how long have you been on the ANSI committee?
As an alternate, I've been probably 7 years, and then as a main member, 5.
Has the wire glass industry ever voluntarily said, this glass is unsafe, people are being injured, maimed, paralyzed, limbs amputated? Have they ever come to the committee and said, let's do something about it? Or have they rather objected to anything that the committee chooses to do?
Senator Walker, the very people that sit here behind me today have denied to the ANSI committee there have been injuries. There was an article written by Mr. Jaremba that says there are a handful of injuries worldwide. That was in 2000, after Mr. Jaremba protested a code change before the ICC. They have denied and denied and denied injuries in existence. And only when the ICC voted for 2 years in a row to remove the exception did they come forward with a compromise proposal to only limit it to schools and to athletic facilities. And I submit to you, how about when you send your children on to college, it's not just an athletic facility, it's a dormitory. How about a hotel when your children are playing in the lobby? They have not admitted to those injuries, and they have done what I view to be misleading statistical studies of the information they provided to the ad hoc committee. And I am actually grateful that they are coming forward and now saying that there are injuries. But this is new. And this is only to avoid what should happen.
And one other question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, in the interest of time. The overhead that you showed us of Central Glass, when did they put that safety exception on their website?
Well, I believe it's within the last 6 months. And that document was a very convincing thing to the ANSI Z97 committee members that had heard year after year from the people that are sitting behind me, it's a safety glass. We should have it in our ANSI standard, which is a safety standard. That is new.
That is brand new. Are they, of the four manufacturers, are they the only one putting something about this not being a safety glass on their website?
No, I would say, well, Pilkington manufactures two products in the UK. One they call PyroShield Regular, which is the glass they import to the U.S. The other they call PyroShield Safety. That is a stronger wire glass. It's the wires are thicker. They developed that product in 1992 when the British standards said that they would implement actually the building safety standard as law. And that British safety standard is the same standard as the ANSI standard, 100-foot-pound standard. They had to make a new product for their UK market and for the European market to comply. And why? They have third-party certification over in the UK. Here in the United States, they do not third-party certify. And what I mean by that is they don't submit to a compliance follow-up program with an independent lab. They will submit, and I would like the committee to ask, what glass was tested in that video? Was it the stronger product that they have in Europe and the UK? Because they submitted a report to the ICC ad hoc committee saying, which the committee believed was the glass they imported over here. We found out through Mr. Abel's investigation it was in fact the glass they make in the UK.
Thank you for pointing that out, because I neglected to ask that question of Mr. Zarimba when they were up here, and I appreciate you pointing that out, because I have asked for an investigation into that matter.
Further questions?
May I ask, add one more thing?
Sure.
When OSBI, and Mr. Abel has mentioned OSBI, OSBI is an insurance agency. It's there to make money. When an insurance agency goes online and then also sends out advisory notices to its schools saying, take it out, is that not what you will be doing in this capacity? Because they are saying, this is not a good product, it's dangerous, get it out of there. And when you talk about film applications, you're talking about a product, 85 cents a market is about the distributor's cost. Mr. Abel didn't talk about the cost, what it took to retrofit the University of Oregon, but it was $375 for 16 panes. It has saved two other young men from being seriously injured. That's not expensive. Now,
I'm sorry, that brings up one quick question. $365 to retrofit their gymnasiums. Were those gymnasiums built prior to 1969 or 1977?
No, Senator, they were not.
I know. They were built just recently, weren't they, Ms. Thiel?
Yes. As an ANSI Z97 committee member, I asked Mr. Zarimba for his data about the schools. I have not yet received it.
All right. Thank you very much for your responses.
Thank you.
Senator Meskoskin, do you have other committee members?
Well, I have a committee next door, but it can wait.
You fine?
If you go next door and tell them I'll be late.
Mark?
Good to see you again.
See you. Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, member of the committees. Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. I'll be brief. I know you're running behind. I just have a couple points, and I want to separate between new construction requirements and then the maintenance and retrofit. On the new construction side, just want to bring this committee up to speed. We have an advisory board that sets code standards in Oregon. It's made up of code experts, building officials, fire officials, industry users. For some time, that group established a committee to review this issue. That committee forwarded their recommendations to our code-making body, and they have recommended to me, as of 2 weeks ago, to move forward with a code change that would, in effect, do something that is similar to what's in this bill. The next step of that code change is to move to rule hearing. Building Codes Division is committed to moving that to rule hearing and proceeding with a proposed code adoption effective October 1st, 2003. We would prefer, as an administrative body, and concur with some of the previous testimony, that these types of matters be placed, removed from the statute for new construction, and allow that administrative process to move forward. And before I go on to retrofit or existing, would there be any questions on what we've done and where we're headed?
Yes,
Senator Nelson. Thank you very much. Just clarifying, do you have a recommendation to move to rulemaking for this from your committee? Sure. So are you saying that the committee has determined that there is a need to make changes in the use of wired glass as a result of the recommendation?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, that's correct. Our technical committee has proposed code change that they look at it as glazing. I think it's a broader term, but it accomplishes roughly the same things as far as areas subject to human impact, and removing that from the new construction codes in Oregon.
And just one quick follow-up. Sure. Again, so the committee would be asking for those changes because they have determined, in their view, that with human impact as a possibility, that the harm of that outweighs the current standard and needs to be changed?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, that's correct.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could ask Mr. Abel to come up and assist Mr. Long in that response, because Mr. Abel, it was actually his proposed code change that precipitated the meetings, and they've had more than one committee. And Mr. Abel, could you just come up? I'd like Mr. Abel to respond to the fact that the decision of the committee was to go beyond simply schools and athletic facilities, was it not, Mr. Abel?
Please introduce yourself again.
Greg Abel, Eugene, Oregon. Yes, when we initially looked at the code change proposal as written for e-occupancies or elementary education K through 12 and gymnasiums, after the International Code Council had met this last year in Texas, they took a floor vote to expand, or to see whether or not it would be accepted to expand beyond the e-occupancies K through 12 and gymnasiums, and the vote of the International Code Council was 300 in favor of removing the exemption entirely to 158 to keep that exception. The state of Oregon was also represented in Texas at that International Code Council adoption. And when we came back to the ad hoc committee here in the state of Oregon, we had a difficult time. I was the co-chair of that ad hoc committee, which was represented by a cross-section of industry, including distributors of Pilkington products, one of the manufacturers to wired glass. We looked at that and tried to justify, if we have determined that wired glass is unsafe in elementary education K through 12 and in gymnasiums, how do we justify its safetiness in other occupancies similar to human impact? And at that time, we were unable to answer that question. So we felt that the best thing to do was to act as the International Code Council Structural Committee had done two years prior, and decided to remove the exemption for all occupancies subject to human impact in new construction. And so we have gone through numerous committees, and the two of the committees voted unanimously to move forward for that change.
Thank you, Mr. Abel. Mr. Long, does that accurately reflect what your department has been doing?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, that's my understanding. Again, our main point is that we believe that there's been extensive review by our code committees, by our ad hoc committees, and by our technical boards, and looking at this, and believe that the actions they're taking is appropriate, and we would appreciate the opportunity to move forward with what our structural code committee has done.
Sure. It's a quick question. This bill on the issue that was brought up, I think, by Mr. Johnson was on line 12, subsection C, that human impact means presenting affordable risk, foreseeable risk, as defined by rule of the department. Do you have a rule, such a rule at this particular time?
Chair Nelson, I would actually defer to others that probably have followed this more technically. I'm not aware of one, but... are you, Mr. Abel?
Any further questions?
Do you have a question? I had a question about the retrofitting, and Mr. Long hasn't talked about that yet, but isn't it true, Mr. Long, that your department cannot draft code provisions regarding existing building structures?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, that's correct. My first comments are directed towards new construction. The retrofitting and existing occupancies would take legislation such as this proposes, and I would like to comment on this as well when I have a chance. Sure. Just in summary, again, we set new construction standards, and currently we don't have a mechanism to have authority to set the existing or retrofit standards, which we've talked about, nor a program in place to effectively carry out that activity without adding additional cost to the organization. And I would like the opportunity to work with the proponents of the bill to look at how we might set up a system of enforcement and action for the retrofit should the bill move forward.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Long. When you and I were having this discussion earlier, one of the options you talked to me about was how Oregon OSHA deals with these kinds of issues, code enforcements, where they don't have staff to go out and do that. Could you please tell the committee what you and I talked about?
Sure. Senator Nelson, Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, there's different ways to look at regulatory oversight, and you can have proactive action where we actually have staff out there checking the various sites, making sure assisting owners and users with identification of the wire glass, or you set up a compliance enforcement provision that provides the necessary incentive for folks to meet the standards adopted through the legislature. And what I would be willing to do is work with the proponents to help set up something like that where you either increase fines or set up some kind of program to compel action. Our main point is that if there's an expectation for building codes to go out and do that, we would need to put a program together, and we haven't identified what those cost impacts would be to the bill. So I hope I answered your question.
Yes, you did. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another question. Mr. Long, I'm sure no one is surprised, at least of all the wire glass manufacturers, to look at Section 5 of the bill, which allows people to make application for an award to help them retrofit or remove existing wire glass in hazardous locations. And in that sub 2 section, it allows them to make that grant from the state of Oregon. That would come, and I can explain that to the committee. I've asked the Attorney General for the state of Oregon to look at joining other attorneys general in a class action lawsuit against wire glass manufacturers for fraud, misrepresentation, just about whatever we can find to throw in that little lawsuit. And from that, we would get a fund that would be set up so that people could make application to retrofit or remove this dangerous glass, and that seems like an appropriate use of that kind of a fine or judgment. Would your department have a problem in being able to administer that, or are you involved in that, and could you tell us how you would address that?
Sure. Chair Nelson, Senator Walker. Frankly, we haven't spent the time to really analyze how we could go about it, but again, I'd be willing to sit down and talk with you and others and see what kind of options are out there for building codes or DCBS to carry that function out. If there's other agencies that would be more appropriate, exactly the best way to go about it. It isn't a function that we're familiar with because we set new construction standards, and I don't have a lot of expertise in this kind of area, so I would hate to overcommit, but I am committed to moving forward on the new construction side and working with you on how to address the maintenance and retrofit. So.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that, because when I gave testimony there on the 5th, I made it very clear that if it wasn't going to get done over there, I was going to try to do something across the river. And I'm very pleased that your committees have moved forward with a lot of due diligence and background and information. They don't make that decision lightly to make that code change. That's correct.
That's correct.
Yes. So the other thing I was going to ask you is, are you familiar, I don't know how far back it was, but are you familiar with a certain type of siding for housing that was sold in the United States, and it was actually what was tested for the product was actually a different product that was actually sold, and it was inferior and caused lots of problems and caused consumers lots of money. Are you familiar with that case?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, I'm not familiar as the building codes administrator, but as a homeowner I am, because I had to replace my siding. And so I'm not familiar with all of the details of the action, but I can tell you that it, unfortunately, great cost to me. I had the opportunity to change my siding before selling my house here recently. So. But I'm not familiar on the technical merits and exactly who did what. But I am aware of it, and so were several other neighbors in my residential neighborhood.
Mm. Thank you very much. I appreciate your response. Well,
in summary, Mr. Chair, again, we believe that the new construction elements would be best placed in the administrative code. Our code-making body has gone through this and has recommendations that are in the hopper, so to speak, and we would appreciate the opportunity to amend the bill to allow us to continue to do that. And I'd be happy to work with the proponents on coming up with ideas for the maintenance and retrofit.
Very good. Thank you. We have two more witnesses. Rock Ivanek and Kathy Abel. Welcome. It's Rock. I'm
Mr. Chair. Yes, it's Rock Ivanek. All right. I've had a lot of fun with that name over the years. Mr. Chair, Senate committee members, I have a letter here that I wrote to the members of the Z91 or Z97.1 Accredited Standard Review Committee that I'd just like to read to you. And it goes thusly. You are about to consider...
Just a second. If it's a letter, could you just hand it in to us and just highlight it and sort of speak from the heart, because we are at some... I'm keeping these people half an hour over their time.
Oh, okay.
Have you given us a copy of this letter?
I believe Senator Walker has a copy of it.
If you could give us a copy, just kind of summarize it, basically
okay,
what it says.
Sure. Well, I would say a lot of times in things like this, a comment might be made like, please don't take this personally, but I would like you all to take this very personally. As a voter, we've placed our confidence in you, senators, to safeguard our children, our family members, and our loved ones. And this letter basically asks you to accept the responsibility for your actions in a very personal way. And in summary, I'd just say that I would appeal to your sense of responsibility in leaving you with this final question. In view of the carnage and devastated lives wired glass has left in its wake, would you allow anyone you love to run near, play around, or impact wired glass, assuring them, it's okay, Mom, it's okay, honey, it's okay, son, that wired glass is there for your safety? I personally guarantee it. I'll be happy to submit this to you.
Yeah.
My name is Kathy Abel. I live in Eugene. And what I have here is a letter from Cindy Neville, whose son was also injured by wire glass. to whom it may concern. I am writing this letter. You just want some highlights?
Speak it from the heart.
Okay,
Cindy. If you have a copy of the letter, make sure we have a copy of the letter so that we get to the committee.
You do have a copy of the letter. Okay. Cindy is a parent of a child that was injured by wire glass, another basketball player who was the MVP, who was first team All-State, and now he has lost the use of his arm. And I just think that there's been enough of this, and I don't think, as a parent of an injured person also, I don't think that this needs to go on anymore. I think that there are alternatives that can be used so that no one else has to deal with this. And Cindy states, I pray that no parent of a child ever goes through what Dave and I did. However, it's common sense that as long as wire glass is inside our schools, our innocent children will pay the ultimate price. It makes me sad, too, that the young people at the receiving end of these tragedies had no say in the matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I have a question for Ms. Abel. Ms. Abel, you're the mother of Jared and married to Greg.
Yes.
Correct. One of the things that really bothered me was that I think it was Mr. Johnson who said that we're trying to bring the lawsuit to the legislature. This legislature should not drive a lawsuit in federal court. Could you, having lived this every day since your son's injury, could you tell me how many hours your husband spends on this issue, how many meetings he goes to, just generally? And tell me, is this motivated by greed, or is this motivated by something else?
This is motivated by the fact that my husband and my son and myself do not want to see anyone else go through what we went through and what other parents have gone through. When I watched my son try to tie his shoes and button his pants, and he couldn't, he as a young man had to go to other young men and say, hey guys, I just went to the bathroom. Can you help me button my pants? That's what motivates this, so that no one else has to go through this, and no one else has to see the depression that I saw my son go through. His hand and his arm won't be the same for the rest of his life. My husband spends hours doing research and contacting people and trying to get accurate information on what he does. It has consumed our lives.
Thank you, Ms. Abel. I appreciate that comment.
Thank you both very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Questions? We have, I think that's the extent of the folks that have signed up for testimony. Appreciate everybody coming and thanking and testifying. I have some concerns as far as the term foreseeable risk, and I'd like for us to address that, and then the issues that Mark Long has brought forth. So we'll close the public hearing on this and not go into a work session until we answer some of those issues, and try and work with the parties to see where we're going with this and what we can do with it. So I appreciate all your help and things that you folks have done, and coming all the long distance and the emotion involved. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So we'll close the public hearing. And no other further business. Committee, we will close the public hearing. Mm-hmm.